This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 171, was recorded on June 13th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. We've had a lot of requests for an episode on real estate markets around the globe, so we're taking a deep dive on the subject with another Macro Voices doubleheader this week. HedgEye real estate guru Josh Steiner joins me as this week's feature interview guest, and we'll focus on the U.S. and Canadian real estate markets. Then Pete Wargent will join us in our postgame segment to talk about Australian real estate. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to systematic trading and investing.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump right into this S&P 500 because after a huge short squeeze rally, we've really spent the rest of this week pinned in a sideways trade range. Which way do you think the S&P is going from here?
Patrick, I'll just be candid and say I don't have strong directional conviction here because I still have very strong convictions in my own mind about reasons that I think the market should move much lower. But it's also been very, very clear for the last several weeks that those factors are not driving the market. What took us down was China, Mexico, and Iran foreign relations. Now, until today's news about Iran and the torpedoing of tankers in the Persian Gulf, it seemed like all of those situations were abating, and I'm also hearing rumors about a China deal perhaps being in the works for late June. So if what took us down in this recent downdraft in stocks was those factors, and they're all getting better, and maybe a China deal is coming toward the end of June, it could easily propel us to all-time highs. That doesn't make sense the face of the way I see the macroeconomic backdrop. I've got the consolation of the bond market seemingly agreeing with me, but the rest of the stock market doesn't see it the way I do. So I'm standing back here waiting to see what happens. I won't be surprised if a China trade deal took us back again above 2,900 or even to a new all-time high. The other thing, Patrick, that's really been on my mind with respect to stocks is there's a relationship with interest rates that's really only been prevalent in this recent cycle, and it has to do with corporate buybacks. The reason that the stock market has been in this crazy rally that just seems to know no end for the last several years, in my opinion, is largely attributable to corporate buybacks. When we had interest rates that were going up quickly and a lot of people predicting that it was going to be a one-way trip to much, much higher interest rates, that, needless to say, made a lot of people think, okay, this whole trend of levering up on debt and using it to buy back your own shares, which frankly is a manipulation to increase the share price for the benefit of the CEOs, as far as I can tell, it's not going to work anymore. That's going to be shut down. Well, if we're headed back to much lower interest rates, it's going to continue working, and that could propel stocks even higher, even as much as I don't think it makes sense given the macro backdrop. So I'm bracing for the possibility of this market moving a lot higher. I can see lots of reasons that that could play out, even though it doesn't make sense for me. My only solace here is bonds are on my side of the argument.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because clearly we went through a cycle where those May highs near 98, simply it wasn't level where we were going to break out. And now we stepped back and had a pretty sharp correction in the start of June. That seems to be stabilizing. Where's the next move in the dollar in your mind?
Well, as I said last week, I think the pullback that we've been seeing has been all about the Fed signaling their intention that a rate cut is on the horizon. So it's no surprise that the dollar would pull back based on that news. Looks to me like maybe it's already bottomed in the last few days. A little early to make that call decisively, but it does appear to be bottoming out. And I think that's a buying opportunity, frankly. And I think the bigger buying opportunity will come when we actually get a real rate cut, not just talk about a rate cut. I think the dollar will move sharply lower in a knee-jerk reaction when that happens. And when it does, I want to be there to buy it because I don't think that interest rate differentials are going to change the equation. Yeah, we can cut rates, but so are other central banks. And I don't think that the cutting of rates is going to lead to an interest rate differential driven failure of the dollar the way some analysts seem to think it's going to. Now, in the spirit of thorough journalism, though, I should say there's a lot of very smart people who disagree with me. Jeff Gundlach just tweeting this last weekend, okay, this is it. Dollar's rolling over. This is the beginning of the end. Perhaps he's right. I don't think so. I think that we're going to see the dollar move higher, but before it goes substantially higher, I think we've probably got a bigger pullback to a lower number after we actually get that first rate cut. And to me, that's going to be a buying opportunity. I'm looking forward to it.
Eric, let's move on to crude oil here. What's going on?
Well, first of all, we did a full update yesterday on Energy Week, so I'm going to focus primarily only on what's changed since then. Now, this week, that's a lot. I'd probably be longer on crude oil, even when I'm not covering anything that wasn't in yesterday's Energy Week. Let's just quickly recap EIA and what happened with inventory. Crude oil building 2.2 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma, 2.1 million barrels on the build, gasoline building 764,000 barrels. The only drawdown was distillates drawing down a million barrels. With those big builds in crude oil and gasoline, that resulted in big selling on inventory day on Wednesday. And it really looked after Wednesday's close like, boy, we were on some critical levels and maybe the market was about to dump, because if we got through that critical support right around $50, there's not a lot of support under it till you get to 45, maybe even 44 to the downside. So it looked like there was a possibility that the market was going to dump. Then, of course, overnight, we had two tankers attacked in the Strait of Hormuz. The initial reports have focused on torpedoes or mines being at fault. And if that's true, it's a big if, frankly, that really implies a state actor. Terrorists have bombs. They have improvised explosive devices. They don't have torpedoes. They don't have submarines. So if this really was a torpedo attack, it kind of assumes there has to be a state actor behind it. Now, we don't have to worry about a long protracted investigation to come to a conclusion of that, because the U.S. State Department, in less than 12 hours after the incident, has apparently been able to determine conclusively, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that Iran did it. And needless to say, that statement played a big role. Now, what happened in the tape action today was actually very interesting. After the news came out, the market had been on critical support. We springboarded off of that, went back above the short-term moving averages, the 5- and 8-day moving average on both RBOB gasoline and crude oil. It only lasted for a few minutes, and eventually we started trading pretty hard back down, retracing almost 50% of that move up on both RBOB and WTI. And then just about 15 minutes before the pit close, Secretary Pompeo came out with the news that the United States had decisively concluded that Iran is the guilty party here, that it was a state-sponsored act and that Iran was at fault for it. Needless to say, that sent both RBOB and WTI back above their short-term moving averages. But what was really interesting to me is where they had been trading in lockstep all day, RBOB stayed there. It stayed above its 8-day moving average ever since the Pompeo news came out. WTI was only there for a few minutes, and then it retraced pretty hard back to the downside. So it seems like, for now, gasoline is kind of holding on to the message that there could be an Iran military conflict beginning in the next few days, whereas WTI is kind of shrugging it off. So it's been very interesting tape action. Bottom line, Patrick, let's bring this all together. The outlook had been big downtrend in play, good reason to suspect further downside. Now we have news that could result in the beginning of a U.S.-Iran war. We had Secretary Pompeo tell reporters today that Iran had done something that is on a scale of badness that would normally warrant a U.S. military strike in retaliation. One of the things that we see quite a lot in the crude oil market is Fridays tend to be up days when there's any fear about a military escalation, because nobody wants to be short into the weekend. Needless to say, there's a very good chance of a rally tomorrow, Friday, as shorts cover to avoid being exposed over the weekend to the possibility of some kind of military upset that might result in a huge gap up open on Monday. But very interestingly, so far, the market is trying to shrug this off. So it's kind of a tug of war. It's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold seems to be holding up. I mean, we haven't broken out above 1350, but it certainly hasn't given back the early gains. What's your thinking? Do we finally break out to new highs?
Well, I think that gold was trying to give back those gains. We saw a pretty aggressive rejection of that 13. Was it 1352, I think, was the high trade? And it was straight down from there all the way back down to about 1325, so giving up 25 bucks. It's been the last couple of days that we've seen more upside. And, you know, we just had the U.S. Secretary of State announce in a press conference that Iran had been at fault for this torpedo attack on two tankers, and that almost certainly would be a setup for military retaliation from the United States against Iran as early as this weekend. So the fact that we're maybe about to start a war with Iran, and it's not a rumor, it's not a speculation, it's something the U.S. Secretary of State said in a press conference, and even that won't push gold back up above its recent high. That says to me that there's pretty strong resistance just above the market. And I've got to believe that people are buying gold on the news that came out today. Somebody else is happy to sell it and keep the price right where it is. So it looks to me like this resistance is pretty strong. Doesn't mean we're not going to get through it, but I'm still leaning toward the scenario of resistance holds and we eventually trade lower.
Well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because after dropping rapidly down toward the 205 level, we started to bounce, but suddenly we find ourselves right there again. Like, if the yields want to take a shot at 2%, do you think we're going down that low?
I think that the bounce was starting until the market got a whiff of this Iran situation. I mean, Pompeo saying Iran wasn't, we suspect them, it wasn't, there's a possibility that they might have been involved. It's in the assessment of the United States, Iran did this. That's pretty darn strong language. That causes a lot of people in a lot of trades to start panicking into their safety trade, which is usually U.S. Treasuries. That pushes the yield down. So I think that today's weakness in the yield, especially later after about 2:15 this afternoon, was probably driven by the Iran news. Before that, I thought maybe a nice bounce was underway, but still, this move has been huge. There's room for a big bounce back to, I don't know, 230, 240 or so would make plenty of sense, even if the trend higher in prices, lower in rates is set to continue. So I'm looking forward to that. It would be nice to have a buying opportunity, but so far we're not seeing one.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Josh Steiner, which is HedgEye's head of financials and real estate. So, Eric, why did we invite Josh back onto the show this week?
Well, the last time that we heard from Josh was in Toronto at our Macro Voices Live event. And remember, at that time, interest rates were moving higher, and most people were expecting them to continue to move higher. And that kind of set a mood around real estate markets, because frankly, real estate prices are driven not by anybody making any sensible assessment of what the house is worth. It's all about what's the monthly payment, what's my mortgage payment going to be, and can I afford it? And that's a function of interest rates. As much as it surprised a lot of people, we've seen a complete U-turn in interest rates. Now that we have what appears to be the beginning of a decline in interest rates that may have some legs to it, that potentially changes the whole name of the game for housing. So we wanted to do an episode entirely about housing. Josh has been probably our strongest expert guest on U.S. and Canada real estate, and we're going to have Pete Wargent join us from Australia in the postgame segment so that we can cover that market as well and try to hit the macro analysis of all of those major real estate markets for our listeners in those geographies and everywhere else around the world.
And we're now delighted, though, to be airing our first sponsored episode this week, right? So, Eric, who made this episode possible for our listeners?
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Although I personally am a global macro investor myself, it has long been known to investors around the world that systematic or quant-based strategies are profoundly effective at extracting returns from the market. Top hedge funds like Bridgewater Associates and Renaissance Technologies discovered this decades ago. And there's one podcast that covers this area of finance better than any other, toptradersunplugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book explaining how these systematic strategies work. Just go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's toptradersunplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. Whew. Okay, that was their sponsor message that they paid for. But there's actually an interesting backstory to how Top Traders Unplugged became our sponsor. So we can come back to that in the postgame segment. But right now, let's dive right into the feature interview with HedgEye's Josh Steiner coming up right after this.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Josh Steiner, who heads up the financials and housing sector research department at HedgEye Risk Management. And I always love interviewing the HedgEye guys because they always come with really great slide decks. Josh is no exception this week. He's put together a really excellent slide deck for us. It'll be a challenge to get to all of the slides, but I'm sure that you, our listeners, will enjoy every bit of it just the same. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered for Research Roundup, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Josh's picture. Josh, last time that we had you for a housing update, I think, was when you spoke at our live event in Toronto last summer. Give us the update, U.S. and Canadian housing, which is the same topic we've talked to you about before. Quite a bit has happened since then. Let's go ahead and dive into your slide deck.
All right, great. Thanks, Eric. Yeah. So why don't we start with the U.S.? So we've got sort of a summary of slides here. What we do is we like to put together a quarterly themes update. And so these are slides from our most recent 2Q19 themes update. So just to sort of set the table a little bit, this first slide we have really looks at the transition from late 2018 to early 2019. So if you look at the performance across the full year of 2018, you can see that the different U.S. housing proxies, XHB, ITB, the S15 Home Subindex, were the worst performing subindexes and ETFs across the U.S. market for the full year 2018, only to completely reverse course in the beginning of 2019 and, in fact, lead the way from an upside standpoint. So, you know, we think that's pretty interesting reversal. We'll get to why that is, but to summarize it quickly, a lot of it revolves around rates. There's more to it than that, but rates are the biggest single driver in the space. So if we think about what is the current positioning of the U.S. Housing market, we look at a number of different sort of core cyclical trends. On slide 5, we can see where the underwriting standards are currently relative to the trailing 15-year period. So you can see that we've bounced off the lows quite a bit. We've come up, this is the Mortgage Credit Availability Index from the Mortgage Bankers Association. We've come off the lows of around 100 to 182. That's down from the epic highs of almost 900 during the bubble years. But we think a normalized credit underwriting environment is going to be in the 3 to 350 range. So we think we still have a long way to go from a renormalization standpoint on underwriting. And if we look at the cycle from a construction standpoint on this next slide, you can see residential construction as a percent of GDP normally troughs in the low to mid 3% range, typically peaks in the mid to high 5% range. Currently, we're at 3.9 off the lows of 2.4. So even though we've come a long way from the bottom, we think we're still only at the mid-cycle, midpoint in the cycle here. And then if we think about another phenomenon, which I'll actually come back to as it relates to Canada on this next slide, if you look at the amount of home equity cashed out quarterly in the U.S. from the mid-1990s to present, in the sort of go-go years of 2005, 6, 7, you were seeing anywhere from 60 to 85 billion per quarter being cashed out of the U.S. housing market. That was sort of the era when The home was viewed as an ATM. The proceeds were used to fund all manner of discretionary purchases. And currently we're at just under $15 billion. So, and this is not inflation adjusted. So this gives you a pretty good sense of how still tepid the environment is relative to where we were for the better part of the 2000s. If we think about affordability in the U.S., you know, you see a lot of headline stories about places like New York City or San Francisco being highly unaffordable. But when you look at the country as a whole, affordability in the U.S. is actually still quite good. So the ratio of median mortgage payments to median rent across the U.S., it typically peaks at around 2. So the trough has historically been around parity, or roughly 1, and we're obviously much closer to that long-term trough than we are the long-term peak. And if we look at median mortgage payments relative to median income levels on this next slide, you can again see, you know, we tend to move between this sort of low to mid 20% range at the trough up to 35 to 40% when we're at the peak. Currently, we're at 23.9%, so much closer to the trough. So all of this points towards this idea that we are still very much mid-cycle here in the U.S., and part of that is just born out of the fact that the housing market didn't really find a bottom until a full 3 years after the broader U.S. economy. So U.S. housing market troughed around November 2011. U.S. economy troughed really in late 2008, early 2009.
Josh, before you go on, I just want to ask you, you said earlier this is mostly about rates, and it seems to me like what we're seeing here is a lot of slides that suggest that, hey, the cycle's just getting going, there's a lot of room left to go, but at the same time, we're also in a cycle of rates coming down for the last several months. If we were to see, as I don't think it's going to happen, but some people think that the bond yields are just way too low, it's going to reverse, we're headed back to 3.5%, 4% 10-year yields. I don't think that's going to happen. But if it did, it seems to me it would really, really squash this cycle that is otherwise recovering. Would you concur with that? And what do you see as the risks of a change in sentiment in the bond market?
So the premise of the question is completely correct in that, you know, we've done work that looks at the sensitivity of housing equities to short-term expedited rate changes, both on the way up and the way down. And effectively what happens is the housing equity driver framework essentially converges down to a one-factor model, which is rates. So unfortunately, I don't have the chart in this deck, but we do have a chart where we look at the rolling delta or rolling changes in the 10-year treasury relative to its correlation to housing equity price performance. And when you get up to around 2 to 3 standard deviation moves in that 10-year yield, again, you do see that correlation with equity price performance for housing equities approach 1. So it really is a one-factor model when rates are moving significantly. As far as the outlook for rates, you know, we do have a slide in here, which I'll get to in a little bit, but I don't think the probable path for rates is to move meaningfully higher over the intermediate to longer term. Sort of cover that in a little bit, but I don't think that's the direction we're likely to take. So if I'm wrong, then this housing trade will go the other way. But you know, we'll cover why we think that's not the case in a little bit. So on slide 10, this is yet another sort of backdrop slide for where we think we are in the cycle and why we think demographics is going to be one of the big ongoing drivers here for the U.S. housing market. So if you look at the number of people in the U.S. who are currently aged either 32 or 33 relative to those who are aged 26, 27, 28, there's a large difference. You can see there's a spike in the number of 28, 29-year-olds. The reason those age bins are relevant is because currently in the U.S., the average age of the first-time home buyer is 32 to 33, whereas the average age of the first-time renter is 26 to 27. So as those renters age up from being 26, 27, 28, 29, 30 to being 32, 33 and start to look to buy their first home, The point of this chart is just to show that there are many more people who are going to be looking to buy their first home in the coming 2 to 3 to 4 years than there are currently. So we think this creates a nice demand tailwind over the intermediate 2, 3, 4 year timeframe. So we've laid out why we think we're mid-cycle here on a number of other fronts. This would be another factor in support of that. If we look at the shorter term, so sort of, you know, thinking about kind of quarter to quarter changes here on this next slide, slide 11, the housing surprise index is a simple measure of whether the fundamental housing data is coming in better or worse than expectations. And so if you think about it, it's basically a diffusion index. And what's interesting about it is that late last year, around December of 2018, this series actually hit an all-time low. And pretty remarkable considering that in 2007 and 2008, we were going through the grips of, you know, what was the largest housing correction since the 1940s. And so coming off an all-time low, it sets up a pretty asymmetric bounce environment. And that's really what we had in the first quarter of 2019. And you can see that at least through April of this year, we had moved back essentially to the zero bound. So, you know, things had gotten really bombed out there over the sort of last 4 to 5 months of 2018, bounced back pretty nicely through the first 4 months of 2019. If we look at the fundamental data on slide 12, these are the weekly numbers for mortgage purchase applications put out by the MBA, the Mortgage Bankers Association. You can see that, you know, going into late last year, activity levels were very subdued relative to where they'd been through the first 7 months of 2018. And then beginning really in January, but trending through March and through April, activity levels have generally been on the rise. And if we think about the setup going forward on slide 13, the nice thing is that the comp setup for pending home sales, so sales of existing homes in the U.S., are going to get easier beginning really in August, but very much easier beginning in November and December. So you're going to have this really nice sort of comp dynamic setup as we move into the fourth quarter of 2019. So really in just a couple of months, we'll be at a point in time when people are going to be starting to think about this environment. So we generally talk about home prices whenever we talk about the fundamentals of the housing market. On slide 14, you can see a snapshot of how those home price trends have been going. In a word, not great. We've seen deceleration in home prices at both the national level and at the 20 city level. And that's coming off what were essentially the high water marks in the March-April 2018 timeframe when U.S. home prices were rising between 6 and 7%. Since then, they've slowed down to around 3 to 4%. We think that trend's going to continue at least through the next several months. I don't know if we'll get down into the sort of 0 to 1% range, but I would expect at least another 1 to 200 basis points to come off of these because home prices are very lagging and they're really reflecting or mirroring what's happening on the fundamental side on a very significant lag, anywhere from 6 to 9 months. So those will continue to soften for the next few months and then probably begin to stabilize as we get into sort of the August-September timeframe.
Josh, I have a question about the composition or the sectors within the housing market. Something I can't help but think about as you're talking there is you're describing why so much of the demand is going to come from people buying their first homes. That means small homes. And although you didn't really get into it, another big part of this is boomers downsizing. It seems like that should put a lot of demand on smaller homes and probably leave a glut of large homes. Is that true? And is there a way to play that from an investment standpoint?
That's definitely the trend. You've got this sort of classic pincer movement on both sides with exactly right. Entry level, looking to buy their first home, tends to be on the smaller side. And as people continue to age up, looking to reduce their footprint. So, yeah, the challenge has been that most builders have generally not been, home builders, have generally not been catering to that smaller footprint because the cost to do so just really haven't worked out terribly well. It's expensive to permit and develop land, and generally when you do that, you want to get the most bang for your buck. There's also a fair amount of risk embedded in the fact that first-time home buyers aren't necessarily always a slam dunk. Sometimes they come in with thin credit profiles, their ability to secure financing still isn't great. We looked at that chart showing the underwriting cycle still has a long way to go from a renormalization standpoint. So I think that's absolutely right. The one name where they're really in the sweet spot for this would be a company like D.R. Horton, ticker DHI. These guys are more exposed to that entry-level segment than most of their peers. And on top of that, geographically, they have a very nice footprint, which is predominantly in the Southeast. So if you look at where most construction is taking place, it's really the South and Southeast are sort of the biggest segments of the country. So D.R. Horton's a pretty nice fit into both of those different bins. So I had sort of foreshadowed earlier that we'd look at rates and the effect rates have played here. And so without further ado, we've got a series of slides here. So slide 15 is actually from our deck at the beginning of the quarter, and it shows that the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, this is the Freddie Mac Primary Mortgage Market Survey, that 30-year had come in from around 5% down to 4.08. Well, since then, it's actually moved down to almost 3.8. So we're down close to 120 basis points off the peak of late 2018. That's a pretty enormous move on a 6-month basis. So if we look back in the next few slides, slide 16, at some of these rate shock analogs, you can see we've got three periods we're highlighting here. So the late 93, 94 timeframe when rates moved up by 240 basis points and then thereafter had a comparable move down in late 98 through sort of spring 2000, 180 basis point move up, followed by roughly 250 basis point move down. And then more recently, you had the taper tantrum in late 2012 running through sort of fall 2013 when rates moved up 118 basis points very quickly and then gave that back over the course of the following year. So in each of those three instances on the following slide here, slide 17, you can see what the impact was following those rate increases, meaning when the rates came back down, on the fundamental activity levels of home sales. So we show that in those green rectangles on slide 17. And you can see that sales activity generally picked up quite nicely in the wake of that. And that's exactly what we've seen, at least so far through the start of this year. And then if you look at the equity side, so home prices for home building stocks, in this case, on slide 18, it's a similar dynamic. So here we're actually highlighting the declines in those home building stocks during the periods when rates rose. But if we sort of skip ahead, we'll take a look at what happened on the rebound. But before I get to that, I wanted to spend just a second on slide 19. And, you know, I think really more than any other, at least in this deck, this slide sort of embodies this idea of what we were, Eric, talking about earlier, which is, you know, if you look at this yield spread, in this case, just the spread between the 10-year Treasury yield and the 2-year versus the Fed funds rate, you can really get a sense for sort of cycles in their broader context. And I think what it speaks to is, you know, so we sort of map out this kind of progression where, you know, you have sort of stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, and you can sort of see how those play out or at least have played out really over the last 40 years, sort of across cycles. And the idea is that, you know, when you get the yield spread as compressed as where it is today, it really tends to happen late in the cycle and after the Fed has already been raising rates for some time. And so even though, you know, the absolute magnitude of what the Fed has done isn't all that profound, at least so far, the reality is that where we are from a yield spread standpoint, coupled with, you know, looking at what the Fed has done at the short end, you know, in the context of these prior environments, it really does look very similar. And so for that reason, we think the most probable path here going forward is that the long end of the curve is likely to remain under pressure. And that's not to say if the Fed is sort of shifting from, you know, being on the front of its feet to shifting back onto its heels, you can't get a little bit of a relief rally. But from, you know, a broader standpoint, where we are in the cycle, we think it's very late cycle. And so that's the idea there. And then to come back to rates and sort of their role to housing here on slide 20, we just sort of put together a simple snapshot here. If you look at the x-axis, you've got the quarter over quarter change in the average 10-year yield. And then on the y-axis, you've got the quarter over quarter change on a relative basis, so relative to the S&P 500 of home building stocks. And so as you expect to see, there's a negative slope here, negative correlation. And the idea is that when you get more than a 50 basis point change in the 10-year on a quarterly sequential basis, you tend to see these home building stocks move up or down sort of in the opposite direction by around 10%. And so that's exactly what we saw over the course of the first quarter. So you can sort of see what the predicted was and what the actual was. Pretty good fit. And then sort of a little bit bigger picture on this next slide, 21. You know, I talked about these three prior analogs for rate shocks and then what happened on sort of the other end of things. So to look at those briefly, so you had the December 94, December 95 period. This is the year following that significant increase in rates. So here you had the S&P 500 home building index gain 35% over that 12-month period. In the May 2000 to May 2001 timeframe, S&P home building stocks were up 75%. Remember, that was a very challenging time for the broader market, especially in tech stock land, as I know you're familiar. But during that same time frame, housing stocks were up 75%. And then following the taper tantrum, you know, the September 13 to September 14 timeframe, home building stocks were up 19%. So, you know, not a great relative return, but again, a pretty good absolute return. And then a pretty similar dynamic that we saw, if we go to this next slide, 22, at the bottom left of this table, you can see in the first quarter of 2019, home building stocks were up 18.4%. So, you know, pretty remarkable turnaround from where we'd been really all year in 2018. And one thing, I guess one final point on the U.S. market on this slide 22 is that, you know, there's an interesting sort of recurrent phenomenon from an equity price performance, which is that most of the time, usually about two-thirds of the time, you get positive, very positive performance in housing equities in the fourth quarter of each calendar year. And then you tend to also see strong positive performance in the first calendar quarter of each year. Whereas the middle of the year, so really 2Q and 3Q, these stocks tend to tread water. And I think part of why that's the case is you have this sort of recurrent hope springs eternal sort of spring buying enthusiasm that begins to take hold really around the sort of October-November timeframe. And so we think that's part of what we're seeing here again. We think things are setting up very well for this fourth quarter rally. So that's what I would leave you with on the side of the U.S. housing market.
Okay, so with respect to U.S. housing, this sector looks pretty strong right now. The one thing that could turn it around completely on its head would be a reversal in the direction of interest rates, but neither you nor I think that's about to happen. And meanwhile, the best action seems to be in the smaller home builders, or I should say builders of smaller homes, regardless of the size of the home builder, who are going to be addressing the markets where the most demand exists. Let's move on to Canada and see how that situation compares with the U.S.
Sure, absolutely. So Canada is almost the mirror image of the U.S. Canada is very late cycle. Canada has a very significant over-leveraging problem at the consumer level. And for these reasons, we'll take a look at why we think the Canadian housing market and the Canadian banking system are going to face a number of years of significant headwinds to come. So let's dive into a few of the more salient points that are really just sort of inexorable fundamental headwinds that the Canadian economy is facing. So the first is slide 24, just a snapshot of mortgage debt. And a lot of these slides juxtapose Canada relative to the US. I think it's important to have things to give you a frame of reference. We know obviously how the US experience evolved over the last few decades. So I think comparing that to Canada's experience is instructional. So on this first slide, 24, we can see that the Canadian housing debt relative to GDP has swollen pretty significantly, particularly since the start of 2000. And relative to the U.S., it's now at levels comparable to where the U.S. was at its peak, right around 70% of GDP. On the right side, we show household mortgage debt indexed to 1970. And on that basis, obviously, Canada is beginning now to, well, has been really for the last decade, leaving the U.S. in its wake. If we think about home prices or the asset side as opposed to the liability side, on slide 25, you can see where U.S. home prices were in 2000, where they peaked in 2006, where they corrected to in 2012, and then since where they've since reflated to. And really over that time frame, Canadian housing prices haven't really looked back. They did very briefly in the wake of the Great Recession, but the magnitude of the drop was de minimis. And, you know, the sort of rally then from 2010 through 2017 was pretty remarkable. And thinking about household debt relative to disposable income on the right, you can see how Canada has really undergone this enormous divergence relative to the U.S. We've got a couple lines in there for the U.S., one which is sort of excluding healthcare costs, and the other which tries to make the U.S. more apples to apples to Canada, considering Canada's healthcare structure. And then if we think about debt service ratios, which is really kind of the important barometer, this is the amount of money you're spending to service your debt, slide 26, you can see on the left BIS data, Bank of International Settlements data, that compares Canada to the U.S. Again, obviously a very significant divergence that has sort of only grown wider over the last 10 years. On the right is that actual divergence mapped. And then on the next slide, 27, same sort of basic idea, debt service ratio. Here we're going about it slightly differently. We're using Federal Reserve data for the U.S. and StatCan data for Canada, and we're showing that divergence on the right here in terms of standard deviation bands. And you can get a sense for just how dislocated these two markets have become on that basis.
Josh, help me out here, because these slides are striking to me. I mean, it really just jumps off the page. It appears that everything was the same in the U.S. and Canada till about 2000. Then prices went crazy in both countries starting around 2000. The U.S. had a peak and a collapse and the event that we all know so well in 2008 and 9. And Canada just kept on going. Is there some fundamental reason that Canada is immune from gravity, or is it different fundamentals that caused the event in the United States? I mean, certainly the corruption around subprime mortgages and the underwriting and the Canada doesn't have the kinds of structured products and sophisticated CDOs and so forth that got us in so much trouble in the U.S. But even if you separate out those factors, the Canadian numbers look kind of nutso to me. Am I missing something, or is it really a situation where Canadian housing is just crazy high numbers that look unsustainable to me?
Well, I don't think Canada is immune to the realities of the fundamentals, and that's really what these charts are designed to illustrate. I think the reality is that Canada had a minor correction following the crisis. I think sometimes what happens in sort of studying examples throughout history is that, you know, economies sort of come out the other side of things. You know, whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger. It seems to be the prevailing wisdom. And, you know, I think based on the fact that the Canadian banking system, you know, appeared to be pretty all weather and came out the other side relatively unimpaired, really emboldened the confidence. And, you know, the two of the markets where you really saw this were both Canada and also Australia, very similar markets in a number of respects. And I think that's part of what creates the real risk in the market is that, you know, you get this sense that, well, we came out of that crisis okay, so therefore things must be fine. And you've really only seen this sort of, you know, leveraging inclination rise over the last 10 years. And so it's really created a lot of the same sort of backdrop that we had in the U.S. a decade earlier. You know, just a growing number of households that are, you know, extremely stretched from a debt standpoint. And, you know, I think there was some data that came out the other day talking about how 48% of Canadians are less than $200 away from being unable to meet their obligations. And, You know, so pretty extraordinary numbers. And you think about the vulnerability of a system that itself is so dependent on the housing market from an employment standpoint and a spending standpoint and a wealth effect standpoint. And you have that large a share of its base that close to, you know, financial trouble. You have a really delicate at-risk framework that really just isn't prepared to deal with any kind of exogenous shock. And so, you know, that to me, it's really a risky situation you've got. And I think these numbers and these charts sort of speak to why that's the case. So very high levels of debt, very high levels of debt service ratio.
Josh, how much of this is being driven by the fact that so many wealthy Chinese who are trying to smuggle money out of China are favoring the Canadian housing market as their favorite place to buy high-end condos, particularly Vancouver and Toronto? In particular, you said, you know, what if there was an exogenous shock? Well, what if China were to really clamp down on that and actually stop that capital outflow, and suddenly the demand by external Asian buyers for Canadian condos went to zero overnight? I mean, you talk about exogenous shocks. That would be a big one, wouldn't it?
It sure would. And actually, it's already been playing out to a fairly high degree. So, you know, there's been a number of regulatory changes that have been put out both at the, well, at the provincial level. So if you look at the West Coast, you know, Vancouver, well, really British Columbia, sort of started this whole thing off with their 15% foreign buyer tax back in 2016. And then recently, I believe it was February of this year, they raised that from 15 to 20%. And then on top of that, you've had, you know, homeowner vacancy taxes. You've had a number of initiatives put in place really to discourage foreign purchasing. And the CMHC came out recently and said that they have pretty good data now to show what the percent of demand coming from overseas really looks like. And for Greater Vancouver, over the 2016 and 2017 timeframe, it looks like between 20 and 25% of all demand was originating from China. So that market has definitely cooled down very dramatically. Volumes there in Greater Vancouver have fallen at 40% year over year for the last few years. And a lot of that is being driven by this reduction in foreign demand. Ontario and sort of the Greater Toronto market are exposed to the same dynamics, but to a slightly lesser extent. So I think part of it is just a function of proximity. Obviously, Toronto is quite a bit further from China than is Vancouver. It's also a larger market. And so the ability for China to simply play as large a role in a larger market like Toronto is a little bit more constrained. But the dynamics are the same. You've seen this foreign buyer tax imposed across the Greater Horseshoe region. That had a significant chilling effect when it went into place. You know, the other thing that's sort of interesting and we've been hearing more and more about recently is this idea that some of these Canadian housing markets are really being used for money laundering purposes on the part of overseas buyers. And that's been an area that has not, until recently, received much attention on the part of Canadian regulators. And, you know, just now, really since the start of this year, you're starting to hear the volume get cranked up. So you're hearing different sort of prominent Canadian regulatory folks begin to finally talk about the sort of scope and magnitude that this problem has played across these housing markets, and they're finally really beginning to crack down on it. So we think that's going to be the next shoe to drop that's going to further curb foreign demand. And then, you know, the other thing to think about is that from the standpoint of the Chinese buyer, foreign property is, you know, not quite perfectly, but almost fungible in the sense that they can buy property in Australia, in Canada, in California, in different parts of Southeast Asia. And so they really do look at a lot of these markets sort of on a relative basis. So, you know, if Canadian house prices have risen threefold in Vancouver, which they have, and at the same time, now you have to pay a 20% tax to buy that house that's risen threefold. And, you know, you're considering that relative to, let's say, buying something in Thailand or in Vietnam or, you know, somewhere else. That disparity, that relative divergence has just grown incredibly wide. And so, you know, all else being equal, Chinese demand for property in Canada and even on the margin in Australia has really been receding over the last few years. So if we go back to some of the Canada fundamentals here on slide 28, one of the things you look for are these so-called Minsky moments, these moments of sort of extreme kind of blow-off top behavior. Think NASDAQ, you know, late 1999, early 2000. One of the gauges for that would be to look at the amount of brokerage activity, really just from, you know, as a share of GDP in the Canadian market relative, in this case, to the U.S. on slide 28. And you can see on the right that in the U.S., versus its long-term average, U.S. real estate commissions as a percent of GDP hit about 3 standard deviations versus their long-term trend. And in Canada, it hit about 2.75 standard deviations at the beginning of 2017. So, you know, pretty much a very similar dynamic. And again, this is what we look for when we think about housing markets that are sort of in excess. We look for similar patterns, similar dynamics. So I think this is one that sort of speaks volumes to some of the similarities. And then it's important to remember that even though it's been a really long time since there's been a housing correction in Canada, there are prior examples. So if we look at slide 29, this is what happened to Canadian home prices in the early 1980s. You had a 17% decline nationally. At the same time, you had the TSX, the Canadian stock market, dropped by 42%. So obviously, a lot of that was clearly driven by sort of the energy policies of the late 70s, early 80s, the price run-up, and then the subsequent housing boom that occurred in conjunction with that. But, you know, you can see that there is, in fact, vulnerability to this market. We had a sort of a similar episode in the early 1990s. This one was fueled primarily by a much narrower sort of window into the Canadian housing economy, which was the Toronto condo market. But here, just Toronto condo market price corrections triggered an 11% national home price correction, which also drove an 11% TSX correction. So it's not without precedent. It's just been an incredibly long time, about 30 years, since the last time there was a meaningful correction in home prices nationally across Canada. And if we look at how fundamentals are beginning to trend here on slide 31, if we look at, you know, year-over-year changes in credit growth, you can see that residential mortgage credit, consumer credit, and then, you know, some of those two household credit are all decelerating on a year-over-year growth basis. And that's really what is sort of keeping the main engine of the Canadian economy going, of course, is credit. So as credit demand is decelerating, that's going to take a toll on the potential for underlying economic growth. And then on this next slide, slide 32, I had shown this slide earlier when we were looking at the U.S. economy, or rather the U.S. housing market, as being still mid-cycle. So recall, these are the quarterly cashed out home equity numbers from 1994 through present. What's interesting is if you look at Canada, so right now, HELOC balances in Canada on a per capita basis as of October were $4,849. And if you compare that to the U.S. on a per capita basis, U.S. HELOC balances are $1,080. So you've got a four, almost five times multiple. To put that into perspective on this chart, that would equate to quarterly home equity cash out volume of about $67 billion in Canada versus where we were or where we are currently of around $15 billion in the U.S. And if you look at this chart, you can see where Canada would slot in these sort of high 60s. You know, not quite as bad as we were at the peak there in 2005, 6, early 7 in the U.S., but clearly in a very different place than where we were sort of post the crisis or pre the run-up to the crisis. So obviously a slide that I think is pretty alarming. So now let's take a look at a few of the sort of regional data points. On slide 33, we have a sort of simple existing home sales stack here for the Greater Toronto market. So if we look at, you know, the most recent data, so this is through May, the first 3 months of 2019, Toronto sales were running at their lowest level of the decade. In April and in May, they've bounced back a little bit. I think part of that is that rates have cooled off a bit, and part of that is a bit of an easy comp phenomenon. But the reality is that even with the bounce in April, May, we're running near the lowest levels of the last decade. Really, the only levels lower are 2018. And if we look at the adjusted month supply, so on slide 34, and I apologize because these are not updated for the most recent data point, but we're generally running at levels that are sort of at or near their high watermarks over the last decade. And if we go to slide 35, we can sort of translate where adjusted month supply are and what that means for home prices. So when you get into this 2.5 to 3 adjusted month supply range, that's going to produce basically a static home price environment, which is what you can see sort of at the bottom there. So we've kind of highlighted in bold there the month supply 2.5 and 3 translates into 5 and 0. And the idea here is really to give people a framework for thinking about what do changes in demand mean, what do changes in supply mean for home prices, and ultimately it's home prices that determine losses, and losses, of course, determine bank performance, but also bank underwriting standards, right? Because banks generally underwrite on a backward-looking basis, meaning that as loan losses begin to build up, they tighten credit conditions, and that's what sort of causes a cycle to go in the other direction. So I've got a number of slides here. I won't spend too much time on them, but looking at some of the different markets, in this case within the Toronto market, so sort of overall, if we look at detached homes in Toronto, they're down about 20% from where they were in early March 2017. The condo market's held up a bit better, detached market not so well. If we look at slide 37, some of the sort of bigger suburbs within Toronto, so Markham and Richmond down 27 and 28% since the high water mark in March 2017. On slide 38, you can look at Vaughan and Ajax down 23%, 17%. On slide 39, we sort of highlight just a few examples, and we have, you know, a much more robust sort of sampling, but, you know, for this purpose, I just tried to trim this down a lot. But if we look at the house on the right, just as an example, you know, here's a house in Markham that sold in 2017 in the spring for a little over $2 million, sold just recently for $1.3 million, so roughly a $700,000 loss, 35%, you know, in 2 years. Look at the example on the left. These are two virtually identical houses, just a few doors down on the same street. You've got, you know, roughly a 27% difference in the selling price between the two. So, you know, I think some of the data you see, particularly from places like Terranet, conveys sort of this underlying calm, which I think is belied by, you know, sort of the real examples you see when you delve into some of these individual markets and really at the sort of ground level individual houses. So I think there's a lot more weakness going on than what you would take away from looking at some of these broader measures. And so if we transition from Toronto to Vancouver on slide 40, here we've got this existing home sales stack again. So Vancouver has just been getting worse sort of every year for the last few years since its peak in 2017. And the first 4 months of 2019, Vancouver have been the worst in the last decade. May, also the worst May in the last decade, a little bit better, but we think the bounce was largely driven by a bit of weakness in rates. If we go to the next slide, slide 41 here, you can see the adjusted month supply for Vancouver clearly trending up and to the right. To put that into the same context as we looked at earlier with Toronto on slide 42, you can see that 9 months of adjusted supply works out to a home price environment where you're going to see prices declining roughly 10% on a year-over-year basis. So obviously a pretty weak environment. Slide 43, just a snapshot of different housing categories in the greater Vancouver area. So, you know, you've got single family, two stories, you know, apartments, composite, all categories rolling over. The change on a year-over-year basis there on the right, clearly moving lower and at a pretty steep rate. And then if we look at here just West Vancouver, as we did for Toronto, where we looked at some of the specific markets, if we looked at West Vancouver, you've got average sale prices of detached homes down 32% from the peak in 2016. So, you know, obviously a lot of weakness there. The other thing that's going on across Canada more broadly, which is very interesting, is you're starting to see a very significant rise in consumer insolvencies. So we actually This data goes back all the way to the early 1990s. Beginning in 2012, they broke this data out from being just total consumer insolvencies to being both proposals and bankruptcies, and then the sum of the two, which would be total consumer insolvencies. And you're seeing this just explosion in consumer proposals, which are really restructurings of debt. And if you look at the trend, if we look at Ontario, for instance, consumer insolvencies in Ontario are up year over year, every month now for the last 7 months. They're up double digits every month so far in 2019. And again, this really comes back to this idea that you have a very large number of people who have borrowed very large amounts of debt, and their ability to service that debt is very strained. And as home prices come down a little bit and the employment picture dims a little bit, and remember we talked about 48% of people being $200 away from being unable to service their debt, it's not surprising that you're seeing these consumer insolvency numbers really break out to the upside. And we would expect to see that trend continue. So this is a pretty important barometer, one that we keep tabs on monthly. There's actually some great follows on Twitter for people who are sort of specialized in this business, if you're interested. And then, so these last few slides are really just a snapshot of exposure profiles across the big six banks in Canada. We profile residential mortgage and HELOC exposures on both an insured and uninsured basis, as well as the uninsured books relative to their respective regulatory capital levels. So I won't spend too much time going through that, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, Josh, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. It's amazing how much this story has changed since we got the last update from you, which was back in Toronto. So we look forward to getting you back on the program soon. Before I let you go, though, we've got another big change from our friends on the marketing side at HedgEye. The last time we had you guys on, they were promoting the All Access Pass. HedgEye has introduced a new premium product called HedgEye Pro, and I had to call my friends in the marketing department to find out the difference. HedgEye Pro is more organized toward longer-term investors. So where the All Access Pass includes those daily risk limits and some of the things that are more trading-oriented, HedgEye Pro is more of the longer term. Now, they've included in HedgEye Pro a new product offering from HedgEye, which is called QIO, Quarterly Investment Outlook. For those of you who are familiar with Keith McCullough and The Morning Show, Keith loves to take everything and break it down into what's the most three important things this day that we need to talk about today. What HedgEye has done is structured a product which is what are the three most important trends in the upcoming quarter. And they've written entire research pieces on each of those three topics, and that's called the HedgEye Quarterly Investment Outlook. Brand new product being introduced by HedgEye, and it's included in the new HedgEye Pro product. So Patrick has done a fantastic job, as always, at beating down our friends Dan and Matt over at HedgEye to get a better deal. They're running a big introductory promo on the website. It's $899 for the HedgEye Pro, and we got an extra $150 off for Macro Voices listeners only. The process there is buy it on the website for $899 and then email Matt Moran, mmoran@hedgeye.com, and tell him you want your $150 refund because you're a Macro Voices subscriber, and Matt will hook you up. And you can find all of that information on the final slide in the slide deck here, or you can just go to hedgeye.com or email sales@hedgeye.com and be sure to tell them that you're a Macro Voices listener to get that $150 discount. Josh, we need to leave it there in the interest of time. It's really great having you back on the show. We look forward to having you back again as the housing market evolves to whatever comes next.
Happy to do it, Eric. Thank you.
Okay, we'll see you next time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to hear Josh speak on real estate markets. I just found it completely fascinating that the situation in the U.S. in his mind is a complete mirror image of Canada. Like when you look at so many of the things like interest rates and between Canada and the U.S., you see so many similarities in their stock markets and so on. But when it comes to real estate and the indebtedness of consumers, it's so bipolar almost. And Josh is really on top of this whole idea that in Canada, it's really still late cycle housing and the banking headwinds that are still coming in Canada. It's always interesting to hear from him. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, Josh's comments about the impact of interest rates on the housing market really resonated for me. I mean, just a few months ago, a lot of us had been telling ourselves, okay, the housing market is rolling over, probably going to get worse before it gets better. What Josh very correctly points out is housing sales are not really about home prices, they're about mortgage payments, and therefore the real estate market is all about interest rates before it's about anything else. And we've seen a major change in view. A lot of people thought once we got past 3.10 on that 10-year yield, it was going to be a point of no return, that was it. And the reverse has been true. Yields have been collapsing. So that should breathe new life into this real estate cycle in the United States. I think that's good news for people that are selling homes. But it's going to be very interesting because we've got some smart people like Julian Brigden saying it's going to be a U-turn in yields. And there are lots of smart people saying that we're headed lower in yields, and that would be good. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, Eric, before we move on to Pete Wargent on Australian housing, we're celebrating an important milestone, airing our first sponsored episode this week. Now, we already heard the sponsor message earlier in the program, but you said you had more to say in the postgame. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm really delighted that we were able to get Top Traders Unplugged as a sponsor. The guy who runs it, Niels Kastrup Larsen, is a lot like me. He's a passionate guy who's very passionate about his particular style of investing. Now, in my case, that's macro. In his case, it's all about algorithmic trading based on trend following. So he's as passionate about that as I am about macro. He works for Dunn Capital Management, which is one of the big CTAs that's been heavily engaged in this whole algorithmic trend following thing. And they've been offering that service to accredited investors for decades. So he really knows his stuff inside out. Just as I enjoy interviewing all of the smartest minds in the world of macroeconomics, what Niels is passionate about is interviewing the best of the quants who actually come up with the algorithms that are driving these computers in these trend following and other systematic strategies. So the reason that I think this is relevant is even for some of our listeners may be interested in learning all about that. If so, that's great. Niels has a super podcast. But for our listeners who are not interested in that style of trading, when we get a guy like Charlie McElligott on Macro Voices talking about how Nomura has gone to all this work to create a predictive model that anticipates key market levels, what we're really talking about is Nomura has basically put together a model that predicts when computers that are programmed by guys like Niels, what they're going to do next. So if you're one of our many listeners whose eyes glaze over when we have Charlie on the program and he starts talking about the CTA model and the levels, and you just can't help but wonder, like, okay, what's a CTA again? And why does Charlie think that's so important? And why should I care about this? I don't get it. How does it fit in? Well, look, the book that Niels is giving away for free at toptradersunplugged.com/macro gives a thorough introduction to what all of this computer-driven algorithmic trading stuff is, how it works, and so forth. So regardless of whether or not you're interested in that in terms of your own investing, the point is it's a free book that will help you understand what the heck Charlie McElligott is talking about when he gets all excited about the influence that CTAs have over the indices. And Patrick, the part that I found most interesting when I got to talking to Niels about this on the phone was he explained to me that, he listens to Macro Voices. He's a regular listener. And he's fascinated by Charlie's emphasis on specific price levels that would trigger repositioning by CTAs. And he thinks that's very curious because, you know, he's one of the guys that programs these CTA models. And he explained that the computers generally care much more about factors like momentum and acceleration of a price move than they do about specific absolute price levels. So I want to ask Charlie about this the next time we have him on the program. I have a hunch that the Nomura guys probably have a lot more in their predictive model than just absolute price levels. But Niels makes a very good point. The way those computers work is really not about prices. It's about other factors. So I'd love to learn more about how the Nomura guys are modeling it, because it's fascinating to me to see the interplay of all these things. Anyway, my bottom line advice to listeners is this: regardless of whether or not you're interested in listening to Niels' podcast, which is all about how the algorithms work in these algorithmic trading systems, consider claiming your free copy of the book, because that will explain what these CTAs are and why people like Charlie McElligott go to such lengths to model and predict their behavior. So that's relevant to you as a macro investor, regardless of whether or not the CTA stuff interests you.
Well, it's great to have Top Traders Unplugged.com as a sponsor. So where does that leave us? Do we have all the sponsorship we need to keep Macro Voices free for our listeners, or do we still need their help in finding more?
Oh, we definitely still need our listeners' help. We have no idea whether Top Traders Unplugged will be our sponsor for the next 3 months or the next 3 years. And so far, we've only agreed to the next 3 months. Our goal is to have a maximum of 2 sponsors per episode. So we still need at least one more sponsor for Macro Voices regardless. Top Traders Unplugged is only sponsoring Macro Voices and one All-Stars episode a week in their initial trial campaign. So we don't have any sponsor for Energy Week or Inside the Investment Committee or most of the All-Stars episodes. So we definitely need more sponsors. And again, here's the drill for our listeners who want to help us, and we so tremendously appreciate your help. I made a detailed video at macrovoices.com/sponsor info that explains all the audience statistics, so I don't have to bore you with them now. What we need is for our listeners to get that video into the hands of marketing departments of companies that would make good sponsors for Macro Voices. You can think of this as doing your part to help keep Macro Voices free for everyone's enjoyment as we continue to expand our network and add more programming. We're trying to be selective and only accept advertising from sponsors which you, our listeners, might sincerely want to learn about so that you don't hate the advertising. So companies like brokers that offer products to sophisticated investors, investment banks, wealth managers, and others whose products or services would truly appeal to the sophisticated investor audience that listens to Macro Voices are the best match. If you want to help us, please start with the video at macrovoices.com/sponsor info.
Well, thanks for the update, Eric. So joining us now in the post game is Pete Wargent, who, it's been a while since we had you on the show, but Pete, we just had Josh Steiner on the show talking about Canadian US real estate. And I just said, we have to get Pete back on the show to give us an update of what's going on in the land down under. So how are things on the real estate market developing in Australia?
Yeah, well, since we last spoke, I think 2017, Australia has been through some quite severe disruption. So the past year has really been characterized by a royal commission into banking and financial services misconduct. So that in association with a regulatory credit squeeze has had a lot of knock-on impacts for real estate. So there's been very little confidence in lending from banks, and we've seen there have been regulatory caps on bank lending anyway. So we've got housing credit growth, and the most recent stats running at the lowest level on record. Nationally, housing prices are down about 10% year on year, mainly driven by the big capital cities, Sydney and Melbourne. And we also had this has been an election year, which rarely inspires confidence anyway. So the past 12 months, there's been a record low housing turnover in the established market. Confidence has been at rock bottom. But there's been a few things that have just happened just literally in the last 4, 5, 6 weeks that might just brighten the outlook a little bit. So the forward-looking indicators aren't quite as bad as feared, but it's been a very tough year in real estate. Lots of redundancies, construction slowing, and the economy slowing.
Now, when you say that there are some brightening signs, when we had you on a couple of years ago, you were talking about a really major, major secular overpriced situation that seemed like it would need a really big unwind to fully correct. Are you saying we've gotten to that full correction condition yet, or are you just saying that maybe things are turning up temporarily?
Yeah, look, in Australia, it's very patchy. So, it's a huge country anyway, Australia, and our markets tend to run in different cycles. So we have essentially the resources states, which are the Western Australia, the Northern Territory, and to a certain extent, Queensland and South Australia. So they tend to run with a commodities cycle, and particularly Perth. I mean, that's been now, I mean, a five-year downturn. States like Adelaide, very few housing affordability issues there over the past decade. So it's really been a Sydney and Melbourne thing where the massive overpricing was seen, and particularly in some of the secondary markets, so further out west, so in places like Western Sydney. So I think it's patchy. In some areas, we've seen corrections of 25 to 30% in nominal terms and more in real terms. Inner city markets are still expensive, but then to some extent, they quite probably always will be. So like, there's still some pain to come for sure. But yeah, there's been a whole range of measures have been taken to get activity moving again. And in fact, there was a shock election result, which probably takes some of the pressure off, because there were a whole range of tax measures were proposed by the opposition party, which would have made housing investment far less favourable. So yeah, the correction has been varied across the country, I guess is what I'm saying.
When we had you on the last time in 2017, if I remember correctly, you felt that the trade there was shorting the banking sector because of the amount of exposure that they had. How has that trade played out? And at this point, is there still an opportunity for a trade? Is it still short? Or are we at the point where it's time to buy the banking sector?
Yeah, so good point. So when we spoke, I was talking a lot about potential bank shorts and people shorting development companies, mortgage insurers, and so on. The banking trade played out pretty well, especially through the Royal Commission. So all of the major banks suffered big corrections, particularly one of the second-tier banks had a huge reputational knock, AMP. But in fact, all of the major banks saw a pretty sharp fall during the Royal Commission. But since that time and since the election, they've experienced quite a bounce. So yeah, possibly that trade is less popular now than it was during the Royal Commission. And particularly, I think there's a perception that the incumbent government might not go quite so hard on the banks from a regulatory perspective. So there's been a relief rally since the end of May.
Now, Pete has shared with us a chart book that all of our listeners can download in the Research Roundup email. Pete, you've shown on this chart book that interest-only residential term loans and interest-only loans. What trend are you identifying here, and do you think this is a turn point?
Yeah, so what I wanted to do here is highlight a couple of the outstanding risks in Australia. So there are two main risks that I see. So the interest-only loan reset is probably the big one. So if you look back to 2015, in many cases, we were looking at about 4 in every 10 loans was an interest-only loan. And what a lot of people were doing was using those loans speculatively, not only investors, also owner-occupiers, and just assuming that at the end of the five-year term, they would just continue paying interest-only. Now, what the regulators have done since that time is they've stamped down very hard on interest-only lending. And a lot of those loans that were written between 2014, 2015, 16 are now coming up to the end of their five-year period, and they're being automatically reset to principal and interest. So what you can see in the charts is there's been a huge drop in the stock of interest-only loans as borrowers are being pushed across to principal and interest, and that is causing a rise in mortgage delinquencies. Now, if you look at the stats and track it back, the peak of interest-only lending was 2015. So that means the peak of the reset is going to play out over the next 12 to 18 months. So that's a risk that everybody is watching closely, because if borrowers, they might see a 40% spike in repayments when they're pushed across to principal and interest. So if there are stressed borrowers and there's mortgage stress out in the suburbs, that's where it's going to show up.
All right. So what is your outlook for the next 12 to, let's say, 18 months in Australian real estate?
Well, it's brighter than it was. If you'd have asked me pre-election, there was a lot of nervous operators. There was a lot of uncertainty. So the Labour Party had proposed some major changes to the way in which housing is taxed, specifically on negative gearing rules, which allow housing investors to offset net rental losses against their salary. Those changes are not going to happen now because the election result went against polling. APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulator, has removed some of its previous caps on interest-only lending. It's removed some of its caps on investor lending. And importantly, in the past couple of weeks, it's proposed removing its interest rate buffer when mortgages are assessed for being written. Previously, all mortgages were assessed at above 7%. That buffer is now being replaced by a 2.5% interest rate buffer. So there's a whole range of changes coming through. The government is also proposing a first home buyer deposit scheme to increase demand in the market. So the outlook for the next year is for a stabilisation of prices after a 10% fall over the past year. But of course, while prices are still declining, there's a lot of uncertainty. The other outstanding risk, and there's still a lot of apartments under construction, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. So there's an oversupply risk or a temporary glut of new apartments hitting the market. So there's a high vacancy rate in Sydney and Melbourne. So that's another thing that people are watching pretty closely.
Pete, obviously interest rates are critically important to any housing market. That was one of the points that Josh stressed in today's feature interview. I understand that there is contemplation, at least in Australia, about quantitative easing. I believe it would be the first time that Australia has ever considered quantitative easing as a monetary policy tool. Give us the rundown. What's going on and what would the impacts and implications be for the housing market if you were to see a QE in Australia?
So at the moment, so the Reserve Bank has been through a period of stability. They wanted to be a source of confidence for the economy, and they held the cash rate at 1.5% for a very long period of time, several years, but recently they've buckled. And we've started a new easing cycle. So interest rates have been cut by 25 basis points to a record low, 1.25%. And if you look at what financial markets are pricing out to Q2 2020, that's a further 50 basis points of easing and possibly more to follow. So the Reserve Bank has flagged in previous speeches that obviously monetary policy is reaching the limits of what it can do. So it's called on the government to loosen fiscal policy to help stimulate the economy. Because in per capita terms, the economy has essentially stalled over the past three quarters or 9 months. So what happens next? Well, there's a potential for some unconventional measures, possibly to a greater extent than we've seen previously. And I don't think it's particularly well understood what those measures might be, but most likely the buying of mortgage-backed securities and possibly the provision of attractive funding to banks. So other things being equal, lower interest rates tend to be supportive of housing market conditions in Australia, especially with the attractive tax benefits for investors. But to a certain extent, that would be uncharted territory. And there might be some nervous buyers if they start seeing unconventional measures and interest rates at levels we've never seen previously.
Okay. Well, thanks for some fantastic perspective on the situation there in Australia, Pete. Before we let you go, please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do.
The easiest place to track me down is just at PeteWargent.com. I do a range of different things in the housing market, but we have an advisory business for fund managers and anyone who's interested in an Antipodean perspective. We put out reports quarterly in terms of what's going on in Australian construction, in the housing market, and in the economy. So, yeah, you can track me down there at PeteWargent.com.
Pete, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to getting you back for an update. Listeners, today's episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free book and subscribe to their podcast as well. We'd also really appreciate your help, listeners, by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, because those reviews on iTunes make a world of difference in our ability to find sponsors to help keep Macro Voices free for you, our listeners. So please take a moment, go on iTunes, give us that 5-star review. It really makes a big difference. It'll only take you a couple of minutes. And while you're at it, stop at macrovoices.com to register your free account, which doesn't cost you a thing. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email which contains links to all of the best content we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Josh, as well as a link to the chart book for Josh Steiner's presentation and the charts we discussed with Pete Wargent in the postgame. There's also a link to a Bloomberg interview with Paul Tudor Jones on his views on gold and a Jeffrey Snyder article titled Commodities and the Future of China's Stall. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. The Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.